So hello, good afternoon. Nice to see everybody here. A big class, that's good. Let me explain to you what I am trying to do with this topic and where I'm taking this forward from Elul. Thank you. We had two classes on this so far in Elul, and only two. The first one was a general introduction, which some of you will have heard, and the second one was a part two of the introduction. But my recollection of that second shiur is we got quite sidetracked doing other things and talking about other things, and therefore we never really covered the second part of the introduction, which is what I wanted to cover. So what I propose to do today is look again at the second part of the introduction, although you'll see that I've slightly changed the sheet, and the reason you can tell the difference between them is the top of this page says 5773 bracket 2 close brackets, which means that this is an upgraded and improved version of the introduction part 2, which we will be... What? Oh, you thought you already had it? You don't already have it. Even if you think you have it, you don't have it, because this is brand new. And we'll see exactly... I'm going to make sure I stay focused this time, that we cover what I want to cover on this. I'll briefly go over what we did last time, but only briefly so that I can finish in time at 6:10, or even a little bit before. The other sheet that I've given out to you, which I'm not going to go over, but I'll just mention here, is a bibliography of suggested articles and svarim and reading. Now, this is not anything you need to read in order to do this course, but if you are interested in looking into this particular issue, the fundamentals of faith, the Ikrim, more, then this is a list of svarim that I'm aware of, that I've found helpful at different times, together with lots of references as to where to get them on Amazon or where to find them on the web. So you'll be able to, this should hopefully be quite user friendly, enable you to go further and deeper into the subject if you want to. Let's get into the sheet. Let me remind you, for people who've just arrived, and this is really the last time I'm going to do this, because I keep having to do this because new people keep coming, but it's fine because the old people can hear it again. It's not a bad thing. The Rambam was the first person to write down a list of principles of faith that a Jew has to believe in. We'll see today why he felt that was important. There have been, of course, mentions, specifically the one that he's commenting on here in the Mishnah, of what it means to be a heretic, etc., and we're going to look at those today. But the first person to really, in an organized and concrete and systematized way, to do this was the Rambam. And everyone's asking why he did this. The place that he wrote these 13 principles was not, as many people think, the Animamins in the Sidur. When you ask people, what are the 13 Ikrim? They say, yes, the Animamins. That is not really strictly correct. The Animamins are a later summary, a poem written by someone else. We don't know exactly who wrote the Animamins, but they were a later poem written to summarize the Yud Gimel Ikrim. There were many, many scores of poems written and songs and different summaries of the Yud Gimel Ikrim, but the real Yud Gimel Ikrim, if you want to find them, can only be found in one place, which is the Rambam's commentary to the Mishnah. When he gets to the book of the tractate, bless you, Sanhedrin, when he gets to the tractate Sanhedrin, he gets to the Mishnah that says, Kol Yisrael yesh lechem chelik le'olam haba, that every Jew has a portion in the world to come. And he says, before I actually write a line-by-line commentary on this Mishnah, which is what he did for the rest of the Mishnah, I first have to give you a hakdama, an introduction, where I explain to you what it means to talk about the world to come, what is the world to come, what is Yom HaMashiach, and what are the things that a person needs to believe in order to satisfy the criteria of this Mishnah to get a place in the world to come. And that's where he lists the 13 Ikrei Hadat. Okay? So in his introduction to the 10th Perek of Masechet Sanhedrin, in his commentary on the Mishnah. And whenever we, during the rest of this year, Be'ezrat Hashem, are going to be reading the Rambam's Yud Gimel Ikrim, we are going to be reading from what he wrote in that commentary on the Mishnah, which is the original. Having said which, it's not quite the original, because I told you in the first year, if you remember, that the Rambam wrote this not in Hebrew, but in Arabic. He wrote this in Judeo-Arabic, which was the language that most of the Jews of his time spoke. And therefore, unless there's anyone in this room who is expert in Judeo-Arabic, which there may be, but I for sure am not, therefore we will be learning from a Hebrew translation. And the problem with the translation is you always have to know if the translation is really what the Rambam was trying to get at. He never translated it into Hebrew. The translation that we will be using is the translation of Rabbi Yitzhak Shilat, who lives right now in Ma'ale Adumim, I should have brought the little white paper in. It is known to be a very accurate and scholarly translation into modern Hebrew, and that is the translation that I will be using. That's the one that my Rebbeim have recommended to me when I've learned this with them, and therefore, just so that you know where I'm getting the information from, that's where there are other translations into Hebrew and into English, but all of them are a little bit different, so we'll be using that one. Fine. Okay, that was just your basic introduction. The Yud Gimel Ikrim, of course, can be divided into three groups, and this is what I mentioned last time. The structure of the Yud Gimel Ikrim, if you look please on page 1, I'm not going to read through this long source, that's one of the reasons that we took a lot of time last time, but this long source is from Sefer HaIkrim, and it's worthwhile getting clear now. Who wrote Sefer HaIkrim? Rav Yosef Albo. When did Rav Yosef Albo live? About 300 years after the Rambam, in Spain in the 1400s. He also wrote a book on the Ikrim, where he agrees sometimes and disagrees sometimes with the Rambam, but he wrote a whole book on the concept of the Ikrim, what are the Ikrim of Judaism, and he explains actually that there are three Ikrim. There are three main Ikrim. Belief in God and understanding what God is. Belief in the understanding that God communicated his will to the world, i.e. through prophecy and through Torah. And thirdly, understanding and belief the idea that God is actually involved in the world. There are consequences to our actions. There is punishment and reward. There will be Mashiach ultimately, and there will be Yemos HaMashiach and Tchiyas HaMesim, etc. These are the three basic Ikrei Hadas: God, God's communication to the world, and God running the world. And he explains in this source that actually the Rambam believes this as well. Even though the Rambam divided it into 13, these 13 are really in these three categories. The first five fall into the Rambam's understanding of what is God. The first five of the Rambam's Ikrim are belief in God, understanding that God is one, understanding that God has no attributes, that he has no physical form, understanding that God is beyond time, that's number four, and that one can only pray to and have a relationship and reach up to God and not through any intermediary. That's the first five, which are all about God. The next four, number 6, 7, 8, and 9, are all about Torah, meaning that there is such a thing as prophecy. God communicates with the world. That Moshe's prophecy is qualitatively different from every other prophecy. That Torah is min hashamayim, that Torah is divine on some level. We have to explain what all these things are in due course. And that Torah will never change. That's the next set. And the last set, which are number 10, 11, 12, and 13, are, if you like, the third category, that God runs the world, meaning Ikra number 10 is that God knows everything that happens in the world. Ikra number 11 is that there's reward and punishment. 12 is that there's Mashiach at the end of days. And 13 is that the resurrection of the dead. So those 13 fit into these three categories. And I brought you, and I'll mention again, in number 2, ultimately it's based on the Pasuk in Yeshaya, Ki Hashem Shokteinu, Hashem is our judge, i.e. involved in reward and punishment. Hashem Mechoikekeinu, Hashem is our lawgiver, i.e. the giver of Torah. The Hashem Malkeinu, Hashem is the king, i.e. God above us all. The Hu Yoshi, and he will save us. This threefold split is based on that posuk, and I brought you, just look briefly at the top of page number 2 please, and we talked about this last time again. This threefold split of God as king, God as the giver of the Torah, and God as the protector and running as the being that runs the world, finds its expression in many different areas: Pesach, Shavuos, and Sukkot, the davening on Shabbos, Yotze Orav, Rav, and Gal Yisrael. I haven't got time to go into all of them now. It's a whole conversation you can go through each, but you'll see this pattern. It's one of these recurring patterns in Judaism. These three things that you see: God as king, God is the giver of the Torah, and God is the controller of the world. Okay, that's basically all I want to say, and it sums up everything we talked about in the last class. Any questions? Right, let's go on. Now, this is really where I want to kind of begin today. The Rambam writes at the end of the Yud Gimel Ikrim the following, in number 5. And I'm going to we'll read this in English, because this English is an English translation of the Hebrew. The Hebrew, actually, let's read it in Hebrew, because it's the Hebrew translation is more original than my English translation of the Hebrew. So let's see number 5. Kaashe yoyde ha'adam, says the Rambam in summary when he gets to the end. When a person accepts be'eile ha'yisoydes kulam, all of these principles, v'yamin bahem emunah shalema, and he believes in them with an emunah shalema, this is probably the origins of the idea of the anima amin be'emunah shalema. It's alright. No one can control their computers, it's fine. Okay, well, it says the Rambam, when a person accepts all of these principles and believes in them completely, Harihu nichnas bichlal Yisrael, he enters the community of Israel.
In other words, the Rambam says, you are only part of the Jewish community if you believe these things. Now, I'm not sure that the Rambam is saying that you're not Jewish if you don't believe these things. In other words, once you don't believe these things, that's it. You're not Jewish anymore. You don't count as Jew. You don't have to keep mitzvahs. I don't think he's saying that. And that's a very hard reading of what he's saying. I think a more likely reading of what he's saying is that you can only count yourself as part of the community and expect to be treated as part of the community if you believe these 13 things. Now, this is just the Rambam's opinion. We'll see not everyone agrees with the Rambam on many areas, but let's just see what the Rambam says. Harihu nichnas b'klal Yisrael. V'chayavim la'avo, we have to love this person, ulurachim alav, and care for him. V'kol ma shechiyev Hashem miktaseinu liktaseinu, everything that God commands us to give one to the other, min ha'ahava v'ha'achva, in love and brotherhood, afilu asa ma she'asa min averis machmas ataiva, even if this person commits sins, even if this person doesn't keep the mitzvahs, they don't keep Shabbos, they don't eat kosher, They don't observe the Lord's Lashon Hara, whatever it is, because of Taiva, because of the Yetzer Hara, the Hiskabrus Ateva Hagarua, and that their evil inclination gets the best of them. Harihu Yenash Yanesh Lefi Meriyoi, he will of course be punished according to his rebelliousness. Of course, you can't get away with it. There will be a consequence. The V'yesh L'chelik, but he has a place in the world to come. In other words, doing Averus, says the Rambam, will not prevent us from having a place in the world to come. Even if you don't do tshuva, even if a person doesn't do tshuva, he'll be punished, whatever that means, and he'll explain what that means later, but he has a place in the world to come. But whom he poishe Yisrael, and he is one of the sinners of Israel, with a place in the world to come. However, the im yitkal kela adam, but if, and this is the magic word, and it's hard to translate, what's lehitkal kel? Who speaks modern Hebrew here? Litkal kel, what's that? To mess up. I think that's actually quite a good translation. Like a kilkul is like a spoil, something got spoiled. If you mess up, it's actually a bit colloquial, and I think it's quite nice. If you mess up Yisoid me'ele ha-Yisoidus, any one of these Yisoidus, I've translated it here as if you deny, but I think mess up's actually a bit better. Other translations I've seen in English as someone who breaks away from or gives up on, something like that, one of these principles. Hari Yotza Min HaKlal, you have exited the community. Kafar Be'ikha, you've denied the fundamentals of faith. Benikra Min, you're called a heretic. Be'apikiris, you're called an apikiris. These are really big words. Calling someone an apikiris is a serious business. Not like today where everybody's calling everybody an apikiris. It's a joke. Like, a real apikiris has certain dinim. Like, they are outside the community in every possible way. The Kaitseits Benetias, and they are someone who cuts among the plantings. That doesn't mean anything. It doesn't mean he's a gardener. This word cuts among the planting is reserved for the worst people who disconnect this world from the next world. One of those people was Jesus, is described as a kaitis and a tears. Anyway, serious business. The chayavim lisanoi la'avdoi. We are commanded to hate this person and to destroy them. The alavu oime, and about this person it says, the haloi misanecha Hashem esme. Do I not hate those who hate you, God? This is a person who messes up these principles. Now, this is a strong statement, and we now have to work out for the next 45 minutes why the Rambam says this, when most people up to the time of the Rambam didn't say this in quite this way. I would say, I've seen a translation of this, that if a person even doubts one of these ikrim, and I even think I mentioned that last time, I don't think that's correct. I've thought about it more, and I've looked at the way it's translated, and I think that's wrong. Even though I have seen people saying, even if a person doubts it, I don't think that's what the Rambam's saying. He's saying more than that. Of course, if a person doubts it, in other words, they say, well, I don't know, I've got to think about this. That's not what the Rambam's saying. It's if a person rejects it, they mess it up, and they say, I believe that God does have a body. That's it. I'm going to eat Mahadrin, Mila Mahadrin. I'm going to keep Shabbos like you've never kept Shabbos before, but I believe that God has a body, and I won't stop believing that, says the Rambam. It's all a waste of time. All the Shabbos you're keeping, all the kashas you're keeping, it's all a waste of time. Or if you turn around and say, I believe the Torah is inspired by human beings, maybe ultimately inspired by God, but human beings produced it, that, says the Rambam, it doesn't matter how many mitzvahs you keep, according to the Rambam, you have no place in the world to come. If a person says, I don't believe in Mashiach, Mashiach's never going to happen, you have no place in the world to come. Even though there was an opinion in Chazal that said exactly that. And we'll have to investigate how can that be. According to the Rambam, do certain members of Chazal not have a place in the world to come? Or did it only become crystallized afterwards?
because there is an opinion. There is not going to be a Mashiach anymore. The Rambam rejects that and says, if you say that, you're an Apikoros. And the same applies to any one of these principles. That's it. Whereas, if you believe all these things, but you break Shabbos and you speak Lashon Hara and you hit people and you beat your kids and all that kind of stuff, you're a wicked, wicked person, and you will be punished, but you have a place in the world to come. So this is quite a strong statement. Yes?
So this is just somebody that is very, very sure of it, or is writing about it, or is talking about it, trying to spread the word?
You mean, how far does this person have to go in order to be called this?
Yeah, or what if they had
the idea? We'll see, somewhere in between what you just, the two things. Had the idea that is not enough to say Yitkalkel. Writing about him being a public, proponent of this new view, I think is too far. But someone who's decided, that's it, I've thought about it, I'm intelligent, I've decided, and that's what I think. We will look at the question of what happens if a person has a view, a clear view, but just out of ignorance. We'll have to see, is that enough to push you over the edge? Let's say a person doesn't believe in the Torah is min hashamayim, not because they thought about it, decided that they don't believe in it, but because they were brainwashed. They think it's stupid because someone told them that Moses is just a mythical figure, and of course, people wrote this, etc., etc. For the Rambam, can that person say, well, look, I don't really have that opinion, I was brainwashed, or is it too bad? We'll see, we'll deal with that question. Exactly. Now, any questions, and I'll move on. Yeah? Fine. Now, before you start thinking that the Rambam is very harsh, we have to learn the whole thing first, and we have to see who he applies this to and who he doesn't. I now want to ask the question, why did the Rambam come to this view? And I want to give six reasons. Six reasons, each of which I've given a different name, and I want to go through them, and you'll see which one you connect with, or if you can think of any other reason why he might have done it, I'm happy to discuss it. Okay, go to page 3, please. The first reason that I've suggested is what I've called here the commentary approach. The commentary approach means like this. The Mishnah itself demands explanation. Let's look at the Mishnah, because this is the original source on which the Rambam is basing everything. Look at number 6. Now, when was the Mishnah written, or put together at least? 200. Around 200 CE. It was put together by Chazal, by the rabbis of the Mishnah, and they include in the Mishnah in Sanhedrin the following. I mean, source number 6 on page 3. Okay? Kol Yisrael yesh lehem chelek le'olam haba. Every Jew has a place in the world to come. By the way, the Rambam clearly holds that every non-Jew can also have a place in the world to come, depending on what they believe. In other words, the Rambam, the emphasis that the Rambam is going to place on belief as opposed to intrinsic right or action is going to work in different ways. It's going to exclude people who you would have thought would be included, but it's also going to include people that you might have thought would be excluded. And one of those clearly is going to be non-Jewish people, because there is no reason why a non-Jew should not have a place in the world to come. Because it's all, at the end of the day, not down to who you are, but what you think. And we'll see that a non-Jew who has his head in the right place is ahead of the game versus a Jew that has his head in the wrong place for the Rambam. And I'm not saying that everyone believes this, but the Rambam really subscribes to this. So every Jew has a place in the world to come. Shenei Mar, and he brings a positive from Yeshayahu, Amei Kulam Sadikim, La'olam Yushi Aretz, your people will inherit the land. The land here is a reference to the world to come. And the Mishnah then goes on to say, Ve'elu, but the following group, She'ein lehem chelek le'olam haba. These people have no place in the world to come, and it gives three groups. Number one, I put the 1, 2, and 3, and it's not in the original Mishnah. Number one, Ha'omer ein tchias ha'meisim min ha'Torah. Someone who says the tchias ha'meisim, the resurrection, is not referred to in the Torah. Number two, ein Torah min ha'shamayim. Someone says the Torah is not from heaven. And number three, apikoros, which it doesn't define. Rabbi Akiva goes on to give other definitions, but these are the three basic definitions. Someone who denies the Tchias HaMeisim, someone who denies Teres Min HaShamayim, someone who is an Apikoros. That's the Mishnah. The Abarbanel. When did the Abarbanel live? Any ideas? Is he on there?
The
Motion of the Jewish Orthodox. See, when I was to ask when did anything happen, I see everybody's eyes go up. Okay? Yeah, the expulsion from Spain. Okay? Why has that been written after? Why is the Chazon? This is like kind of the whole of the last 500 years got concertina in the two little bits here. Okay, we should really continue around there. The world didn't end at 1492. You thought it did. According to some of you, the world only began in 1492. But so the Abarbanel was in the expulsion from Spain. He actually led the expulsion from Spain. He was one of the politicians, the Jewish politicians in Spain, Tony Yitzhak Abarbanel, he was originally from Portugal, went to Spain, then he ended up in Italy. He was, and he wrote one of the first and major commentaries on the Rambam's Yukim Ha'ikra. Look what he writes in number 7. Maimonides did not present these principles and foundations because the Torah would collapse with the refutation of any one of them. He says, no, the Rambam didn't write these 13 Ikrim because they, without them, the whole Torah falls apart. No. Why did he write them? Rather, it was intention to explain the Mishnah. It's as simple as that. The Mishnah says these three kinds of people. The Mishnah says all Israel has a portion in the world to come apart from these three kinds of people. The Rambam simply wants to go and explain who these people are. This is what the Mishnah is saying. But really the Rambam is not doing anything more than just explaining the Mishnah. And Apikoros is his first set, which is people who don't believe in God or believe God has a body, etc., etc. People who deny Torah's Min HaShamayim is obviously the second set about Torah. And people who deny Tchiyas HaMetim is the third set, which is talking about how God controls the world. So the Abarbanel, if you like, slightly downplays the Rambam and says, no, the Rambam is not making a major new philosophical statement. He's simply commenting on the Mishnah, and that is the first approach. But the second approach, I think, is more fundamental. Have a look at the second approach. I want to volunteer, please, to read from source number 9. Because source number 9 is what the Rambam has to say about the world to come. Yes, Katie.
In the world to come, there is no physical body, but rather the souls of the righteous alone, without a body, like the malachim.
Now, you have to understand that this expression, olam haba, is very ambiguous. When I say to you in this room, olam haba, what do you think? And you may all think different things. And there are two, I mean, you may just be thinking of like eating chocolate or something like that. I don't know. That's not what I'm thinking that you might be thinking about. Okay? I'm hoping that we're a bit beyond that now. But there are two basic approaches in the Jewish commentaries about what Olam Haba is. Either it is a physical world of endless, eternal, immortal bliss like Gan Eden in this world, when the body and the soul are reunited forever. Or, according to the Rambam, who rejects that totally, it is a completely spiritual world in a completely non-physical setting, detached from this world in a an ethereal plane in a different dimension. That is Olam Haba. And how all of these things fit together, how Mashiach fits in with that, how Tchiyas HaMetim fits with that, each approach has its different kind of timeline as to how these things work, but that's the fundamental different approach to Olam Haba. And the Rambam is going to tell us that really Olam Haba is all happening in a non-physical world, and that's going to be very important. Carry on, please. Katie.
Since there are no bodies, there is no eating or drinking or any of the things that a person's body requires in this world.
Is there a cold air on?
No,
it's very hot in here. Yeah. Can we open the windows, please? Because unless I can turn the cold air on if you want.
It's cold outside.
Open the windows, please, because I can see you all falling asleep. From the heat. I let me assume it's from the heat as opposed to from the boring shirt. But anyway, let's go. So let's go. Since there are no bodies, read that line again.
Since there are no bodies, there's no eating or drinking or any of the things that a person's body requires in this world.
And he wants you to know that there aren't any virgins waiting for you in Olam Haba, if that's what a person was expecting. So the Rambam is saying, no, it's happening. There's nothing physical in the world. So what in the world to come? So what is happening in the world to come? Carry on.
Rather, the righteous sit with their crowns on their heads and enjoy the radiance of the Shekhinah.
Which, of course, is a contradiction to what he just said. Why? Because you can't sit without knees. Try it. Doesn't work. And you can't have a crown without a head. So what's he talking about?
And when it says that the righteous will sit, this is allegorical, i.e. the righteous will be present.
We should say there with a R-E, sorry, it's a spelling mistake.
They will be present there without work or effort. Similarly, when they refer to the crowns on their heads, this means that the knowledge that they have and through which they merit light in the next world is present with them and serves as their crown.
Right. The knowledge that they have through which they merit life in the next world is like the crowning feature of their neshama. Now, the Rambam, this by the way, the original Hebrew was written by the Rambam. This is from the Mishnah Torah. This is from here, the Rambam's Halacha Sefer, in Hilchas Tshuva. In Hilchas Tshuva, he says, in order to do Tshuva and to connect with God, you have to understand what is the world to come. And he says, the world to come is the place where you exist as what? As the knowledge that you amassed in this world. It's your knowledge. It's what's in your mind. It's what's in your head that gets you the next world. Not anything physical. That won't get you the next world. Your knowledge will. Ah, so what's the role of physical mitzvahs? Eating matzah, shaking lulav, doing all the things that physically we do. Do they get us the next world? So the Rambam says, no, they don't. They don't get us the next world. They get us the thing that will get us the next world, but the next world can only be achieved through your head being in the right place. You are, if you like, the sum of your mind. Obviously not your brain. Your brain is a physical thing as well. But your mind is not a physical thing. The billions and trillions of little sparking, whatever, synapses, whatever they are, beyond the electrical impulses, is what you are. It's the real Taylor. It's the real Ashley. This is just a lump of meat that we carry around with us that we need in order to interact in this world, but it's not me. The very fact I call this my arm means this arm is not me, because it's my arm. Okay? That's the first piece. Now, he goes even further in number 10, in the Morin Nebuchim. Katie, since you've started us off, why don't you go even further? Here he's going through different levels of perfection, different levels of character traits. Okay?
The third level is perfection of moral character.
By the way, the first two levels, which I didn't give you because they're not really on topic, but I'll mention them, says in order to perfect yourself, the Rambam says, the first two levels are perfection of your physical and financial circumstances. In other words, you have to have a healthy body. The Rambam was a doctor. He wrote many, many medical works on everything, even the most mundane things, and how to cure this and how to cure that. He was even approached by the son of the sultan that he worked for, who had a large harem of women, and said, I need someone to advise me on sexual health and how to deal with like 45 women, who all of which expect to be part of my harem. And the Rambam says, no problem, sir, I will produce for you a guide to healthy sexual living, which he did, and he produced many other medical guides as well. So medical and physical perfection, the Rambam took extremely seriously. Getting enough sleep, hint, hint, okay, and getting the right food, etc. And financial security, so that you're settled and you know what you're doing, etc. So then you move on from physical and financial to number three, which is moral character traits. Carry on.
Both of the mitzvot are solely to achieve this level of perfection.
That's a very radical statement, by the way. What are the mitzvot for? You ask someone in the street there, what do we do mitzvot for? Olam Haba, Belzio Neshama, connect to God, says the Rambam. No. Most of the mitzvahs are designed in order to build the right kind of moral fiber, in order to make you the right you that you can then go on to the fourth level. Carry on.
And this level of perfection is itself only a preparation for another and not an end in itself. The fourth level is true perfection of a person, which is the attainment by that person of intellectual virtues, i.e. an intellectual framework from which to learn a true understanding of the divine. This is the ultimate goal and the true perfection of a person which belongs to him alone, through which he may merit eternal existence and through which he is truly a man.
A human being is only a human being through their intellectual achievement. And that's how you get Olam Haba, says the Rambam. And the mitzvahs are just a necessary, by the way, you can't do it without a mitzvah. You can't sit and contemplate God and never do a mitzvah, because he says that just won't work. You're over-optimistic. It's like the Greeks. The Greeks were in many ways very optimistic. So you can really achieve perfection through thought alone. Well, sometimes it doesn't work. I can give you all the books in the world on how to learn to swim, and you can read them from cover to cover and write a PhD on them, and you won't be able to swim. I can give you a written treatise on how to tie your shoelaces, but you'll never learn how to tie your shoelaces unless you tie them. And that's, if you like, a simplistic comparison, but it's saying the mitzvahs are essential to actually get us there. But if the mitzvahs only get us to the physical act and never to the cerebral understanding, then the mitzvah hasn't achieved anything, really. Ashley, you had a question.
Yeah. I think I understand now, but so the first three levels of perfection, the goal of them is essentially the fourth level of
perfection. Right. Which itself, the goal of that fourth level is to give you the knowledge which connects with God. And therefore, that's why the Rambam spends an incredible amount of time in the Morin Nebuchim giving you the reasons for all the mitzvahs. It's not good enough for you to just do a mitzvah like a robot, saying, my kavana is to do the mitzvah, says the Rambam. You have to know why you're doing this mitzvah. Because the whole point of the mitzvah is to bring you to the cerebral connection with God. And look at number 11, which is Rambam at the end of Hilchas Mezuzah. I'll read this to you. Chayev Adam li'izai b'mezuzah. A person has to be very careful about their mezuzahs. Mipnei shehi chayvas hakol tamid. Because everybody has this obligation, and it's a constant obligation. As soon as you have a house, you have to have a mezuzah on the house. V'kol zman sheyikaneis v'yetzer. Every time you go in the house and come out of the house, yifka v'yichud Hashem. You will come smack in the face with yichud Hashem. What's yichud Hashem? Hashem's oneness. In other words, every time you walk through the door, it's as if you had a little kind of, almost like a cartoon flapper on the door. There's something flat hits you in the face and says, Hashem Echad, every time you walk through the door. So that's what the mezuzah is. Every time you walk through the door, this mezuzah hits you in the face and says, Hashem Echad. Which is an incredible, if you thought about mezuzah every time you walk through a door, think about how many times, it's almost hard to understand how you could do this and still be a kind of normal person. But there obviously is a way to do this. And just think, oh, Hashem Echad, in that way. Okay? V'yichud Hashem Shmoy Shel HaKadosh Baruch Hu. V'yizkor Ahavasa, and you remember to love God. Why? Because it says in the mezuzah, V'yahavta as Hashem Elokecha b'chol levavcha b'chol nafshecha b'chol miyodecha. Yeah? By the way, b'chol nafshecha, or b'chol nafshecha, these are big words. With all of your soul, with all of your money, with all of your heart, even if you had to give up your kids, even if you had to give up your home, even if you had to give up your life, you have to love God more than that. These are like a big word to hit you on the head every time you walk through the door. The yer mishnasa, they'll wake you up from your sleep. The shkiyasa, from your mistakes in life, from your ridiculousness. The heavenly hazman, from the shtuyot that we get upset about. Oh yeah, I forgot to get the car serviced. Oh, what am I going to do? The car's going to... Worried about the car being serviced? Look at the mezuzah. You know, think about things that are important, he says. And look at this, I've underlined these words. The yeda, and then you'll know when you see this mezuzah. She'ein davar ha'omed la'olam u'liyol mi'olavim. That nothing is eternal and for all eternity. Nothing stands for eternity. Ela yediyas tzur olam. Other than knowledge of the rock of ages. The God himself. And then you'll come back into your head. You'll get your mind back. And that will cause you, the mezuzah will cause you to get your head straight and to walk straight and to act straight and to be a proper person. The earlier Chachamim said, if a person wears tefillin on his head, ubezor on his arm, tzitzis v'begado, and tzitzis on his body, umezuzah bepitchoy, and mezuzah on their door, they have a guarantee, or they have as much a guarantee as they can have, that they won't sin. Why? Because there's so many reminders. These are the angels, these are the malachim, which are saving us from sinning. Now, the Rambam is a very beautiful Rambam, but it's actually very radical. Because if you ask somebody, why do I put a mezuzah on the door? What is it achieved to put a mezuzah on the door? And people will say, well, either they'll say, it protects your house. Which really is probably not right, according to like any opinion. Yeah, it may protect the house, but only because it's a mitzvah. It's not a magic amulet. If you think the mezuzah has some kind of charm that's coming out of it to protect the house, that's just straightforward avodah zarah. Yeah, there's no real excuse for that. When I was a student at Oxford, so we had a woman that came to clean the room every day. So at the end of my year, I think it was my second year, at Oxford, this lady came up to me, she was very shy, she said to me, excuse me, sir, but they like that Oxford. And they said, I just wanted to ask you a question, because me and the other cleaners have been having a bet as to what that thing is on your wall. So I said, oh yes. I said, and what did you bet it was? She said, well, I've been thinking a lot about it. She says, I think it's an air freshener. She said, I'm all right. So I said, well, it's a kind of spiritual air freshener. So anyway, I don't know what the others thought it was. You know, Lord alone knows what the others thought it was. But the point is that, you know, it's a mitzvah. So people might say, well, I'm doing a mitzvah. The Shmira comes from the mitzvah. And it's the mitzvah that binds me to Hashem. The Rambam's not even saying that. He's saying, no, it's not the mitzvah of putting the mezuzah on the door which will get you olam haba. It's the fact that when you see the mezuzah and you think about the mezuzah and you realize all the correct thoughts, that will get you olam haba. Now, I just want to point out to you that this approach is totally not agreed by a whole group of other people at the time of the Rambam. And there's a major fault line that goes through Judaism, not a fault line, maybe a major debate that goes through Judaism, as to whether the mitzvahs themselves have intrinsic, mystical, Kabbalistic meaning. You know, when you do a mitzvah, things are happening in different worlds, and that act itself in somehow changes the nature of reality, which is the main way that people are learning today and are taught it today, or the way that the Rambam looks at mitzvahs, which is the mitzvahs are a way of preparing you intellectually for the real thing, which is connecting with God. Yes, they can. Well, yes. And look, in other words, the people who say that the mitzvah itself does things in other worlds also agree that connecting through your mind to God is an incredibly important thing. Of course they agree with that. The question is, does the Rambam agree that when you do a mitzvah without understanding at all what that mitzvah achieves, that somehow, you know, clicks cogs and changes gears and does things in other world which will affect your olam haba? That I'm not sure he will agree with. Okay, If, however, you understand this is the Rambam's approach to Olam Haba, now you know why he's writing the Yud Gimel Ikrim. Because it's not just good enough that you keep kosher and you keep Shabbat. If your head's all wrong, you've been doing all these mitzvahs and you've been davening to the wrong God. Let's say you daven every day of your life with incredible fervor, but you're davening to, you know, the wrong God. You're davening to this cup of water with incredible, you know, fervor. So what did that achieve for you? Like a grand total of nothing. Yeah, but your heart was in the right place. Yeah, but you davened to a cup your whole life. What do you want from that? So the Rambam will say, well, similarly, if you daven to a God that you think gets happy and sad and has mood swings, you just daven to a cup. You didn't daven to God. You daven to something you thought was God. You could as well have davened to an old man with a long white beard. That's not God. You know, people often say they don't believe in God. You say, well, describe God to me, and they describe, like, well, God's a man with a long white beard. I don't believe in that. You know, I don't believe in that either. You know, so the now you understand why the Rambam, according to this approach, has to focus much more on what's going on in here, and feel like shift the focus away from what's going on in the world of action, because Torah traditionally has always been more about what you do than what you think. But the Rambam says, no, what you think is critical. Okay? Questions? Clear? Fine. We go on. The Abarbanel gives another approach, which is that... by the way, before I leave it, there is more to be said on this. And I wrote you a little footnote here, in number 7, before we go on to the scientific approach, that there are indications in the Rambam's writing in other places that mitzvahs alone do bring some level of Olam Haba. And if we were to give a whole class on that, I would bring you those sources as well. I've mentioned them at the bottom in the commentary. There's a Mishnah at the end of Makkos on which he comments on, and there's a Halacha in Yisodei HaTorah. There is more to be said about this. There are indications that the Rambam does give some, if you like, credence to the idea of mitzvahs connecting you intrinsically, but there's much more to be said about that, and I only wanted to bring what I needed to bring in order to make this point. Right, D3, let's go. The Abarbanel, this is an easy point, basically quite criticizes the Rambam for writing the Yud Gimel Ikrim, and he says as follows: that which I believe to be true, certain and established in this matter, is that these men, Maimonides and those that follow him, it wasn't just Maimonides, there were other people as well, Chizkai Kreskes and others, Rabbi Yosef Albo, are peaceable with us. In other words, they have the right intentions. Meaning what? They were brought to postulate principles in the Divine Torah only because they were drawn after the custom of the Gentile scholars, as described in their books. For they saw that in every science were the natural mathematical roots and principles which ought not to be denied, argued against. Okay? There are roots and principles in all of their cases. Meaning that the Abarbanel says that the Rambam looked into science and says whenever you define science, you have to define the basic principles. Everything has principles, and from these principles, everything else stems. So Torah must also have principles. Why? Because if science has principles, Torah must also have principles. And therefore he wanted to define the principles of Torah from which everything else comes out. Thus, when one doubts one of the assumptions of a science and contradicts it, it can be clarified and proved with these general first principles. You go back to first principles. We even have that expression in English, going back to first principles, because we're so scientifically oriented, since they are the roots on which the entire science is based. Now he has something very critical to say. Our scholars, having been dispersed among the nations, they got influenced by non-Jews, and having studied their books and sciences, learned from their deeds and copied their ways and customs with respect to the Divine Torah. They said, how do these Gentiles pursue their sciences? Which is an oblique reference to a posik, which is not very complimentary. By positing first principles and roots on which the science is based, I will do so also, and postulate principles and foundations for the Divine Torah. In other words, the Abarbanel kind of says that their whole concept of Yud Gimel Ikrim is not very Jewish. The whole Torah is Ikrim. God didn't say any mitzvah is more important than any other mitzvah. He said, do everything. How do you know what's more important? Maybe Shatnez is one of the most important things. Maybe Shomer Negiah is like a fundamental idea of everything is. You can't take one and say this. It's this that is. And the Rambam felt he had to do that because every other science does that, so we have to do that too. And the Rambam is critical. And he actually denied that there are Yud Gimel Ikrim. He's not denying that these 13 things are important. Of course not. But he's saying you can't take these 13 things out of context and say everything else is like subordinate to that. And therefore, it could be that there are those who criticize this. And of course, this has become a very important question. Why? Because in the Rambam's day, it became important. What's that? Yes, now because of the Enlightenment. Then, the Rambam was living in an age where there was a lot of pressure on Jews to define what they believe. The Rambam lived in a world where Muslims were forcing Jews to declare their belief in Muhammad or die. He also lived in a world of crusades where Christians were doing similar things. It became extremely important to define what are the basic things we believe in. At other times in history, that kind of became much less relevant. If you look in the 15th, 16th, 17th and 18th centuries, it becomes, or certainly the 16th to the 18th century, it becomes, people are not really bothered to talk about this that much. It's much less relevant. They're much more being, you know, attacked by blood libels and things like that than being forced to debate their principles. But then, as Shira said, once you hit the Enlightenment and the Reform movement and the Conservative movement and people challenging Judaism, then people once again have to say, well, who's in and who's out? What do you have to believe to be a Jew? And now, you'll see almost a universal acceptance of the Yom Kippur Ikra. Open any Siddur. Open the article of Siddur. And look at what it says about the Yom Kippur Ikrim on the Ani Ma'amins, which of course, as I told you, are not really the Yom Kippur Ikrim, but whatever, it's the closest most people get. It says almost universal acceptance. Can you stand up now and say, I'm an Orthodox Jew, but I don't believe in God?
No.
I'm an Orthodox Jew, but I don't believe in Torah Menah Shamayim? No, absolutely not. You can't say any of these things, because these have become the things that, if you like, define what it means to be an Orthodox Jew. And the other people, whoever the other people are the people that argue with these things. So now it's become very important again. If you argue like the Abarbanel argues, who said these things were so important, then you start, it's a bit of a game changer as to you know, who's in and who's out, and that becomes an interesting thing. One point I'll just make on that is whilst almost every Orthodox Jew you'll ever meet will say they believe in the Yud Gimel Ikrim, most of the people won't know what they are. Those who do know what they are will know what they think they are, and probably not what the Rambam says they are, which is actually very ironic. Because the Rambam says, you have to believe these things in order to get to Olam Haba, and I'm going to tell you what these things are. And then people, after the Rambam, took on those 13 things, but actually disagreed with the Rambam about what they mean. So most people today actually believe in the Yom Kippur Ikrim, but not the ones that the Rambam says you have to believe in, necessarily, in the way that he believed in them. And therefore, I wonder, according to the Rambam, who exactly else, apart from him, who else is in Olam Haba with him? You know, I'm not sure. Maybe all those people who didn't come to a clear opinion on the matter because they just didn't know what they were talking about. I don't know. One of the questions always on the Rambam, and we'll go through this, we'll get lots of more in the book as we go through, is was the Rambam an intellectual elitist? The clear question, the answer is that, so yes. But the question is, to what degree? What happens if you don't have any intellectual powers? What if you're just not interested? What if you're happy just to kind of watch soap operas and not think about anything? So I'm not sure the Rambam is going to have much to say about that. Very positive. But what if you're very pious? If you're your classic, you know, Jewish grandma, and you're not that interested in, you know, philosophical debates. You're just very kind of good, but you don't actually understand or believe anything. I'm not saying that Jewish grandmas don't understand or believe. There are Jewish grandmas that are, you know, world class intellectuals. Of course there are. But I'm using it as a, you know, what does the Rambam have to say about that? What does the Rambam have to say about people who are incapable of intellectual understanding? Now, as we know, somebody who is incapable of intellectual understanding to the point that are actually intellectually subnormal, whatever that means, we have to define that, shoter, is exempt from mitzvahs. And therefore that's an entirely different category. But what about kids? What about children? Do children have a place in the world to come? What if a baby of 1 month old can't understand anything? Do they have a place if that baby dies in the world to come? And if so, how do they get it? These are all questions that we need to ask on the Rambam. I mean, the same is true, by the way, of mitzvahs either. If mitzvahs bring you to the world to come, again, how does a child have a place in the world to come? They don't do mitzvahs. But these are all questions we have to address. And one of these main questions is, again, is the Rambam such an elitist that he kind of rules everybody else out and only a few people are included in? One of the other problems with the Mora Nevuchim, which we'll see as we get through, we'll see the specific quote, is when the Rambam writes in the Mora Nevuchim, all these things that he writes in the introduction to the Mora Nevuchim, that in order to make sure that you really understand what I'm saying, I am going to say things in the Mora Nevuchim that I don't mean, in order to throw you off the scent, so that only those people who really understand what I'm saying will be able to see through that and understand the inner and deeper esoteric meanings of what I'm saying. And he actually says, and this is how all good books are written, including the Tanakh, he says. Which is an amazing statement.
Wow.
Okay? So he says, so if you just read the words and think you understand them, you probably don't understand them. So this, of course, throws the whole Mora Nevuchim, and maybe even other books, open to other questions, which is, well, you think it means that, and it says that, but does it really mean that? That's what you think. Maybe it means this, maybe it means that. And then this is why learning Mora Nevuchim is a complicated thing, which is probably one of the reasons why most people don't learn it. Okay? Fine. Let's look at the last three approaches, which are very interesting, and we'll finish. think we'll even finish a few minutes early, which is the first, I think, which is as follows. There is a polemic approach to this as well. As I'm sure you're aware, many of the svarim that we have from the classical period have been censored. Censored by whom? Christians, by the church. The Gemara that you see in front of you on the shelf, this Gemara here, this is a censored Gemara. All the bits that the Christians didn't like have been changed in this Gemara. Okay? The standard Gemara that you buy in a standard bookshop is always the censored Gemara. Now, very little of it has been changed in real terms. It doesn't make any difference to the mitzvahs that we keep. But there's stuff that talks about Jesus, there's stuff that talks about Christianity and the early Christians, which has all been deleted. Sometimes, you know, just in a very kind of the church during the Middle Ages. Usually Jews who become apostates, who knew the Talmud and how to navigate through the Talmud. We even have manuscripts with like red lines drawn through them. Take out this bit, put in this bit, change this word. For example, every time it changes the word, every time it has the word min, mem yud nun, okay, the word min is a reference to the early Christians. Okay? Min. Which means a heretic. Because the Christians call themselves, the early Christians call themselves the ma'aminim, meaning the true believers. And the Gemara calls them, they're not the ma'aminim, they're the minim, which are the heretics, okay? Fine. So the church didn't like this. So they said, take out the word min, and substitute the word akum, okay? What does akum mean? It's an acronym for Oyvei Kochavim Umazolos, someone who worships stars. So the Christians said, we don't like the word minim, because we don't want you to talk about us, we want you to talk about pagans. So he's talking about someone else. And therefore many of the words min were just deleted in the Gemara and replaced by the word akum. Sometimes, even in a quite unintelligent way, there are even Gemaras where the expression arba minim that you take on Sukkot, the lulav and the esrog, the arba minim, which don't mean min at all, they just mean the arba minim, the four types, have been substituted with arba akumim. There even are sort of unintelligent senses like that. But you can buy all the naughty bits and put them back in. There's a little book, it's quite small, which you can buy, which has all the stuff that was taken out. It's not clear to me why this hasn't been included now in the standard, the back of the Gemaras. I can understand why they didn't put it back in the page, because it will mess up all the pagination, and people don't like that because they see the Gemara in a very kind of sort of structural, visual way. But you could put it in the back. I don't know why they haven't done that yet. No, we have manuscripts. We have manuscripts. We have many manuscripts which are not censored. Yeah. There are thousands or at least hundreds of manuscripts of the Talmud from... The Talmud only started being printed 600 years ago. It existed for at least another 800-900 years before that, and there are manuscripts in extant from that period. Yeah.
What does polemic mean?
Oh, polemic. Polemic means it's a debate. It's actually not so much of the substance, but it's there to, if you like, I can't remember exactly the difference between polemic and rhetoric. Someone can come and correct me. I'm sure people will write it and tell me. But polemic, in other words, he was making a point publicly against the Christians and the Muslims. Look at the uncensored version of the Rambam, because the Rambam was also censored. There were entire chapters almost of the Rambam that were taken out by the church. And here is a few words that were taken out. Shlosha hema kofrim b'Torah. There are three types of people who are heretics, who deny the Torah. Ha'omer she'ein Torah me'em Hashem. For example, someone who says that the Torah is not from God. Bekena kofer b'perusha, someone who denies the oral Torah. For who Torah shebal peh, which is Torah shebal peh. The hamachshuk magideha, and someone who contradicts those who give Torah shebal peh, either rabbis. Kogoyim tzaduk ubaitus, these are the Sadducees and the Baituzians, famous groups from the Second Temple who broke away from the rabbis and denied their interpretation of Torah shebal peh. The ha'omer, or someone who says, shehaboyri hichlit mitzvah zor, that God took a mitzvah and changed it, the mitzvah acheres, and now has a new set of mitzvahs. And someone who claims the Torah has now been abolished and there's a new Torah. Even though it used to be from God, now God's changed his mind. And these are censored words which I put back in. Kagoyim, such as Hanoitrim, the Nazarenes, which are the Christians, the Hagarim, and the descendants of Hagar, who are of course the Arabs. Okay, the Muslims I should say, not the Arabs. All of these people are heretics. Which is an interesting question, because one of the questions that one has to answer on the Rambam and other people is Islam Avodah Zorah? Is it Avodah Zorah to be a Muslim, or is it just heresy of some kind? And what are the implications? And they may have implications as to whether you can daven in a mosque, which many people do, or whether you condemn it in a church, etc. Yeah.
So, if the professor is a Christian, why does it talk about loving the
Jews? Because that's a good question. I assume that the Muslims must have got their hands on it as well. But they did take these words out. Someone took these words out. She asked, "If why would they take the words the Hagarim out as well? Unless you... I don't know the history. It's an interesting academic question as to the history of this deletion. Could it be that the Christians just didn't like the whole idea of the rejection of substitution theory? Because their whole religion is based on substitution theory, so they took the whole thing out because... I don't know. Or maybe it was the Christians took this bit out, the Muslims took that bit out, etc. It's a good question, but it was taken out. Yes?
The Gemara says that
it talks about the Yishma'elim. It doesn't mention the Muslims, because Islam came about after the Gemara. So the Gemara has nothing to say about Islam whatsoever. It has a lot to say about the Yishma'elim as a group of people. We now connect the Yishma'elim, because they connect themselves with Islam. But the Gemara doesn't necessarily do that, because there was no such thing as Islam. The Gemara was put together in the 5th, 6th century, and Islam started in the 7th century. So, there you are. Now, so there's a polemic maybe. The Rambam is making a point. We need to believe what we need to believe because these people are Christians and these people are Muslims and they are heretics and they're not what the Jews are, and therefore he wants to make this point. He wrote some very important letters, the Yigeret Teiman, the letter to Teiman, and the Yigeret Hashmad, to Jews who were being desperately persecuted in Muslim lands, forced to convert, and there was a big question as to whether they were allowed to do this. There were many Jews walking around openly as Muslims in the North Africa in the 12th century, but actually secretly as Jews. Which is an interesting, what's that? He says that you do not have to die rather than say, I believe in Allah and Muhammad is his prophet. Whereas you do have to die rather than become a Christian. All the Muslims really wanted from people is for them to say, I believe in Allah. Well, we do believe in Allah. Allah is just a name for God. We also call God Allah, by the way. The Jewish soldiers, they call God Allah. It doesn't mean Elyon. It just means on high. And then you say Muhammad is his prophet, you know, what does that prove? Nothing. They don't think Muhammad is God. It's just a statement. Okay? And he said, obviously it's not right to say, but you have to die rather than say it. Which other people disagreed with. And this was a big important thing. Now, the last two things I just want to pop into your head is 5 and 6. Why might the Rambam want to have written these Yud Gimel Ikrim? So what I've called the philosophy debate approach. That the Rambam was very into philosophy. He wanted to really put everything to question. Everything should be philosophically debated. And that got him into a lot of trouble. Because people were saying, no, the Torah doesn't work on philosophy. The Rambam says, yes, it does. And it could be, and there are those who suggest this, that the Rambam put these 13 things on the table and said, okay, boys and girls, these 13 things I'll give you are ikri, ikri hadat. They're undebatable. They're undisputable. They're not open for negotiation. I agree with you. But the effect of doing that is to say that everything else is open for debate. Think about it. This is one of the things that Abarbanel didn't like. Once you say that you're a heretic if you believe these 13 things, that means that you're not a heretic on anything else. What happens if you turn around and say, I believe the world is 25 billion years old? There's nothing in the Yud Gimel Ikrim that says that. That's a problem. What if you believe that the book of Isaiah was written by two different people? I mean, that may be wrong. But there's nothing in the Yud Gimel Ikrim that says that that makes you a heretic. What if you believe all sorts of things? What do you believe the story of the flood is allegorical and never actually historically happened? Now, people might jump and scream and shout and say, you're a heretic, but the grandma will say, wait a minute, where does that come in the Yud Gimel Ikrim? If it doesn't fall in, then it's open to debate. So you might actually argue that rather than actually closing the debate down, the Rambam has very cleverly opened the debate up. Because everything else is now fair game, which is an interesting question. And the last approach that I wanted to give you, which was suggested by one of my own teachers, Rabbi Kimchi in London, which is, it's similar but different to what I just said, which is I put the Parashanut approach, which is the Rambam was very well known for his position on non-literal readings of Chumash, of different things. As I think I mentioned to you before, the Rambam understands that certain parts of Chumash cannot be read literally. It is offensive to basic fundamentals to read them literally. Anything that obviously implies that God has a body has to be read non-literally. Anything that implies that anyone had a physical interaction with a malach has to be read non-literally. You can't have dinner with a malach, you can't dance with a malach, you can't speak to a malach, you can't do any of those things. So of course this opens the Rambam up to, well, okay, according to you, what is literal then? Did the Exodus really happen? Did Moses really exist? Like, you've got to draw some lines, Rambam. You've got to draw some clear lines here. So Rambam says, you know something? Fine. I'm going to draw these lines. These are the Yud Gimel Ikrim. If anything offends any of these lines, you're right. I'm not going to go against that. But beyond that, again, you know, I want to have some room to maneuver. There's nothing against the Yud Gimel Ikrim to say that when Avraham Avinu, in this week's Parsha, and next week's Parsha, I should say, has dinner with Malachim, that he's having it in a vision, not really in real time, which the Rambam says. Even though other people scream and shout and say, you can't say that, the Rambam will say, no, why can't I say that? That's not, none of the Yud Gimel Ikrim are offended in any way by me saying that. So these are all reasons why I would suggest the Rambam may have written the Yud Gimel Ikrim. Well, he did write them, but the reasons that made him write them. Yes?
How is the fifth one
explained? The fifth one seems to be just saying that the Rambam wanted to give himself some space to be able to debate other things, and therefore he put these 13 things down, and he said, these things I won't give on, but actually everything else I want to have open to debate. So he fixed these things, but other things he didn't fix. Maybe I didn't answer your question. What are you asking? Because he wanted, according to this approach, he wanted to give himself the space to debate the things he wanted to debate, and therefore the things he wrote down kept everybody happy, and now, you know, you can't accuse him of being a heretic. People accuse the Rambam of being a heretic. They burned the Rambam's works. And therefore the Rambam wants to, why? Because they said he steps over the mark. So he draws the mark, so then you'll know where the mark is to step over the mark. And he can say, I didn't step over the mark. But then people say, oh, you just drew the mark. You can't draw the mark and say, I didn't step over the mark. Like, anyone can do that. It's like drawing, you know, firing the arrow and drawing the target around it. But anyway, much more to debate. Now, I haven't yet decided whether I'm going to start with Ikka 1 or whether I'm going to start with Ikka 6. I haven't decided that yet, because I did last year Ikkas 1 to 5 and 10 to 13. But I haven't yet done 6, 7, 8, and 9. So I may start with 6, 7, 8, and 9, or I may start at number 1. I don't think it really makes any difference, because they're all interesting. Might make a difference to Ashley, because she heard number 1 before. But it might not be a bad thing to do over it anyway. So by the time you get me, you'll know what I propose to do. And either way, it'll be hopefully interesting. Okay, have a lovely day. I wish you a good week.